And justice comes in lots of different forms. The title of today's sermon, Mind the Mules, comes from an old saying, don't mind the mules, just load the wagon. That saying cuts two different ways. The metaphorical meaning is an injunction to have faith. Do your part of the job and other parts will take care of themselves. The saying also reveals an attitude about living things other than ourselves. I want to consider today how it is we can mind the mules and better respect our connection to the web of life that sustains us. I grew up on a farm in the southern part of Illinois, which is about 2 hours straight south and east of here. When I walk out the front door of my parents' house today, I'm looking straight east. When I was a kid looking out that door 40 years ago, there was a farmhouse southeast of me, a farmhouse southwest, a farmhouse to the west, a farmhouse to the northwest, and a farmhouse to the northeast, all roughly a half mile distant. A little before my time, there had been a school, a church, and a small store all within about a mile's walk. Today, only my parents' house remains. I can see one other farmhouse out that front door. It's about 2 miles away. I can see it due to clearing of woodland for the purpose of farming efficiency. Most days, now, only the U.S. mail goes by on the road in front of my parents' farm. Going a little bit further back in time, there's a spring a few hundred yards from my parents' house that at one time was the focus of a Shawnee Indian village. They were a semi-nomadic people who spent the winter months encamped at the spring. They were exterminated in the 1830s. My family arrived on the farm in the 1840s and bought the land from the U.S. government. It had magically passed into U.S. government hands for $2.40 an acre. My great-great-great-great-grandparents, who are European immigrants, are buried about a mile from the house and something part of what was once the farm. Those immigrants established a system of farming that continued until I left for college in the late 1970s. They raised horses and mules, donkeys, cattle, hogs, sheep, goats, chickens, and geese. In terms of crops, they raised corn and wheat and sorghum and various grasses for pasture and hay. They raised apples, grapes, and other fruits and vegetables that they ate. There were walnuts and hickory trees in the yard. There were berries in the fence rows and woods. Except for the commodities of cloth and steel and a few manufactured items such as dishes, it was a closed and self-sustaining farm system. Now the land produces corn 4 out of 5 years and soybeans 1 out of 5. And in a half mile square that once was a community, now only my parents live. Now, I'm not going to try to give you a picture of nostalgic good old days. After all, the land was stolen from those Native Americans to begin with. The U.S. government wasn't much concerned with what happened to the land out here in the recently cleared Indian country, since there was plenty of land left to steal farther west. Furthermore, the southern Midwest looks a lot like northern Europe. So the farmers who settled here stuck to what they knew. The southern Midwest isn't northern Europe, however, and thanks to an extraordinarily stupid farming practice system they set up, we have now managed to lose over half of the topsoil that was here in the 1840s down that big drainage ditch in front of the church here called the Mississippi River. There's nothing that was a golden age, in other words, about the farming system that my great-great-great-grandparents brought here. And I'm not nostalgic about the good old days. I don't like carrying water from the well out in the backyard. I don't like going to an outhouse at 4 a.m. in the snow. I don't like it that wasps always build their nests under the seat of the outhouse in the summertime. I don't like living in close proximity to snakes. I don't like the suffering of animals. And those of you who grew up on farms know that it's always the kids' job to go kill the Sunday chicken, I guess because kids have the energy to chase them down. I don't like killing chickens. I don't like killing hogs or cows. I don't even like hunting. I hate the smell of hot blood. And my grandmother, as my grandmother would say, I somehow turned up in the wrong turnip patch. I just wasn't cut out to be a farmer. The fact is, in the 1970s, I could see the handwriting on the wall about farming. Either I would have to become an industrial farmer and get bigger or get out, as the saying went, or I would have to insist on a type of primitive farming of the type Wendell Berry pursues with horses and a lot of good sense. I wanted a job in the air conditioning, and so I left the farm and all the hard work. And I broke a chain of agricultural life that goes all the way back to whenever it was human beings began to farm. I don't have any illusions about dukes and earls in my family. And in many ways, I regret having broken that chain, because despite the snakes and the blood, there's nothing like freeing the hooves of a newborn colt from its mother. There's nothing like helping a newborn calf struggling to its feet for the first time. There's nothing like watching a newborn lamb struggle to find its voice. There's nothing like the wise stare of an old sheep. There's nothing like the power of a good mule. We human beings evolved with the animals that we kept, and something is lost when we break that cycle. And there's something extraordinarily sad about a society that, for the most part, doesn't know how to feed itself, and a society that doesn't know where its food comes from. And our society does not know the cost of our food. Mad cow disease, E. coli, salmonella, botulism, no records to tell us where meat comes from or where it goes, as we saw in the recent Downer cow thing. Who is protected by not telling us where the meat goes? Milk and wheat and peanuts and fecal matter in the wrong packaging. Sometime when you have nothing better to do, not before a meal unless you're dieting, go to FDA.gov and spend 15 minutes reading about our food supply. One major recall makes the news, but there are 15 recalls for every one that makes the news. And then reflect that 80% of our seafood, 45% of our fruit, and 17% of our fresh vegetables are imported, and that the FDA itself says it inspects less than 1% of food imports. We North Americans simply don't know where our food comes from, and neither does our government. Then reflect, if you aren't too depressed at this point, on our total dependence on fossil fuel to produce our food, to package our food, and to transport our food, as I read this morning. The fact is, the way we produce our food has caused irreversible environmental damage, has created an insupportable food chain, and destroyed a way of life. And in fact, we can't do much about it. Let's look at one cause of the problem. The National Labor Relations Act of 1935, going a bit back, the law that provided most U.S. workers with the right to collective bargaining back in those liberal New Deal days, excluded domestic workers, agricultural workers, and small farmers. They could not unionize. Still can't. This was an instance of realpolitik for the Roosevelt administration, since it needed to keep Southern plantation-owning Democrats in the Democratic coalition. But the compromise had a couple of disastrous consequences. First, Since a sizable number of African Americans were domestic servants, agricultural laborers, or small farmers, the compromise postponed the civil rights movement for another generation, exactly as the plantation owners wished. It also ensured the suffering of millions of migrant workers to this day, despite the best efforts of people like Cesar Chavez. Second, it ensured that farm workers and small farmers would have no voice in government policy whatsoever concerning agriculture. The consequence of that killed the family farm, damaged the environment, and is now killing the U.S. population with bad food laced with corn and soybean derivatives. The farm subsidies that made a real difference in the problem of overproduction during the Depression era turned into guarantees of profitability for factory farming after the Second World War due to the political power of large farmers and corporations. Western European farmers, on the other hand, and now all farmers in the European Union, have the right to collective bargaining. They can unionize. This means that small farms with free-range animals are the norm rather than the exception in most European Union nations today, though the World Trade Organization has begun to damage the system with factory farming of the U.S. type spreading now in Poland, the Czech Republic, and some parts of Eastern Europe. The WTO requires each nation to pass its own agricultural regulations, and it further requires that within certain limits, nations not ban imports from other nations based on agricultural practices. The U.S. plays that card quite often to sell things to Europe. This is one of the reasons we see the world's peasant farmers standing in the streets alongside bomb-throwing anarchists at WTO demonstrations. The kind of farming I learned as a child has pretty well been stamped out in this country and now in most of the world. The fact is, my children don't have much of a connection to the land, not the way I feel it anyway. For them, the farm is mostly an inconvenience, not a way of life. It is almost inconceivable today to reflect that my grandmother was not only born, gave birth to her own children, and died in the same house, but also in the same room and in the same bed. On the one hand, who wants that kind of stasis in your life? I didn't. On the other hand, there is a grandeur to knowing where the sun will rise each day of each season and of living close to your ancestors' bones. What does the farm mean to me now? I don't even know myself. Forget stocks and bonds. I can sell the farm today and make more profit simply by putting the money in a savings account. There's no dark conspiracy to what happened to the American family farm. It was simply greed, coupled with bad government policy, coupled with a bubble in national wealth that sent farmers to factories. My father worked in Granite City, which is where I was born, building Sherman tanks. And we can't go back to the way the farm was. As I pointed out, it wasn't a golden age anyway. Yet, we can go forward in a different way, in a way of respect. I vividly remember the last time I saw my grandfather, the guy I was talking to the kids about. He was sitting on his front porch, an old scraggly chicken resting between his feet. My grandfather rubbed the chicken's head with his cane. He respected living things because they kept him alive. He minded the mules, and he taught me to do that. I learned that when I had to do harm or kill, I should do it without hesitation, because that's the kindest and quickest way. I learned to see the interdependent web and to live in it as lightly as I could. You know, mules aren't really stubborn. We humans anthropomorphize animals rather than actually looking at them. A horse is a flight animal. Horses evolved in the open plains and survived by running away. Mules take after the donkey side of their families. Donkeys evolved in the mountains. They couldn't run. That would have meant falling down the mountain. Instead, they learned to stop and think and react carefully. We do well to mind the mules because, as my grandparents knew well, mules are very wise after their fashion. And going forward, we can be wise as well, I hope. Just as donkeys evolved to be careful, we human beings evolved to cooperate with each other and to look down the road into the future at least a little bit. There are options out there if we're willing to think about them. We can stop factory farming in this nation. Every aspect of farming is controlled by federal law, any of you who've ever tried it. Every aspect is controlled by federal law. Help change those laws to favor small, environmentally sustainable farms. Right now, the cards are stacked against us. One place to go to find out about that is farmsanctuary.org. Farmsanctuary, one word, .org. Join up and just see what the government is doing. We can support organic farming as well. It's simple. Buy organic. Organic food is not necessarily healthier for people. Don't get involved with the arguments about that. But it's very difficult to follow a factory farming model in organic farming. So organics are better for the environment. Thankfully, even smaller grocery stores now have organic. Buy organic. It's good for the environment. Third, become that weird new word, the locavore. That is, a person who gets most of your calories from the local farm economy. It was picked as the word of the year last year, locavore, by Webster. Why do that? Less waste of fossil fuels, as mentioned here, in transportation. Less waste in terms of packaging. And it supports local farmers so that perhaps the small family farm can come back, not as it was, but in a new way. As a locavore, you can ask questions. And believe me, a farmer is not shocked or embarrassed if you ask how that chicken or that sheep or that pig died. It's all in the day's work for a farmer. We can respect the interdependent web of life by looking the farmer in the eye and asking him some simple questions about where your food came from. Admittedly, most of our sisters and brothers on this planet and in this nation can't afford to ask where their lettuce comes from. They got to buy it for 99 cents if it's available. They're lucky to afford food at all. It is up to us, those of us who have a little bit of comfort in our food buying choices, to look down the road. It's up to us to educate and to legislate and to do what's right. Now, I'm not a scientist and I don't play one behind the pulpit, all right? I don't know if cloning and genetic modification are good or bad things. I do know that respect for animals and plants is essential to good health and good stewardship of our resources. And cloning and genetic modifications, it seems to me, don't show much respect for living things. What I do know is that when it comes to agriculture, no magic ever occurs. Everything we eat is part of the soil and the sun. There is never a free lunch. When we eat, we consume food, and the life we consume becomes part of us. We consume plants and animals, and the labor of the human beings who raise the plants and animals, process the plants and animals, haul the plants and animals, and serve the plants and animals to us. There's nothing magic about our food, no matter the wonders of the advertising or the packaging. Food is always about suffering, even when you're a vegetarian. And we're lucky to get what we've got. That's why my family and a lot of old farm families pray pretty fervently before we eat. We know the cost of food. And that's why food justice is such a difficult thing to pin down. What we eat next can seem like a very small thing, yet it's part of a huge chain when you look at it. Though economies of scale and the welter of advertising obscure the reality, eating is always a sacrificial act, a holy act, and things die even if we're vegetarians. As an old farmer who has struggled too many hours in the sun, who has looked in the eyes of too many dying animals, I ask you, if you remember one thing today, to think of eating as a religious act. Consider praying an old Buddhist prayer that my teacher, I'm glad you're having a beatnik thing here, that's great. The Buddhist prayer taught to me by my old poetry teacher, Allen Ginsberg. It goes like this: we take this food, the labor of many people, the suffering of many forms of life. We wish to be worthy. Steve Ettlinger, in an entertaining book called Twinkie Deconstructed, anyone read that one? Goes looking for the sources of those mysterious ingredients in Twinkies. Things like, well, you know, wheat, but also chlorine and cellulose gum and the ubiquitous yellow dye number 5. What Ettlinger discovers is that some of the things in a Twinkie grow in the field, some of it is mined from the ground, much of it is processed in factories whose processes are top secret and they won't let him come in to see. Yet, ultimately, even a Twinkie comes from the earth. Our food, all of it, even Twinkies, comes from an interdependent web that stretches from the earth to the sun, from next fall's harvest to the human past, from wherever we live to wherever the ingredients of our next meal come from, 1,500 miles away or in the backyard. Food, whatever our supposed level of civilization, whatever our personal remoteness from its production, wraps our animal selves into the web of life, like it or not, realize it or not, think about it or not. Let's embrace the tie and be conscious of it. Let's respect life in its immense variety. Let's be true to our evolutionary potential of looking a little bit farther down the road than just now. It's up to us to mind the mules so that all of us can get there on the wagon. So may it be.